The last speaker is Mario Hudelist from the University of Vienna. He will be talking about the relativistic theory of elastic bodies in the presence of gravitational waves. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Give me a second. So can you see my screen? And can you hear me?
Yes. Yes, we can see it.
Perfect. Hello, my name is Mario, and I want to thank you for having me. I have the pleasure to give the last talk of this amazing meeting. Unfortunately, COVID struck me, so I can't be take part there, but I just want to apologize in case my voice cracks down. Okay, let's start. Okay, so I want to tell you a little bit about joint work with Stefan Palenta and Thomas Mieling. We were interested in elastic bodies and how they act to gravitational waves. So our main key points of interest were first finding a relativistic description of an elastic material, and then also figuring out how it responds to a gravitational wave. Before I jump to the general relativistic part, I want to give you a little bit of intuition from classical elasticity. Suppose we have one shape on the left-hand side, which can be our reference shape, and then we have, let's say, some small deformation on the right-hand side of the same shape. And if we want to understand how to relate both in terms of displacement, we can find this displacement vector here, which I highlighted in blue, and write the configuration in terms of this displacement. I highlight this because at the end, I will present to you a solution for the displacement, but for a general relativistic description, including a gravitational wave. Okay, let's keep this in mind. Maybe it helps a little bit for intuition. Let's jump to the general relativistic part. We see here on the right-hand side, manifold. It's called the body manifold. You can see it as our reference state, assuming there exists one. And it's made up of all the particle of a material, the continuum, whatever you want to call it, the body in question. And then we have on the left-hand side a space-time manifold with a Lorentzian metric. And we assume that the body is moving through this through this space-time. For our purpose, I will focus on having a four-dimensional Lorentzian manifold on the left-hand side and a three-dimensional Riemannian manifold on the right-hand side. We now are interested in finding, again, a function. It's called the configuration map that relates the point on the space-time with one point on our reference metric. We also want the particles on the space-time to move along a time-like vector field, which is the four-velocity. I already apologize that I will use the letter V to indicate the four velocity because I reserved U for the displacement. Okay, let me give you a few examples of tensors which are used in elasticity theory, but already a warning, there are many of them and all have different names, and I will pinpoint out which ones I've been using. So here we have space-time deformation tensors, the finger deformation tensor and the left Cauchy-Green deformation tensor. And for the material part, we have the right Cauchy-Green deformation tensor and the Piola deformation tensor, which I used in my computations. So much to that. Then we need a notion of strain. So to speak, if gamma is our reference metric, then the difference between the deformation and the reference metric will give us our strain. And then there's, of course, a space-time version of that too, where we use the deformation gradients. Those are the derivatives of the configuration maps to translate between the space-time and the body manifold. Okay. Starting with a stress energy momentum tensor coming from a Lagrangian field theory, it can be shown in work of Robert Baik and Schmidt that this can be derived in this form. I will omit that now, but I will later point out the references. For now, let's just focus on how this version looks like. We have energy density, and then this part is time-like with the fall velocity, and then we have a spatial part, that's the Cauchy stress here on the right-hand side. And from here, we want to now figure out for a consistency check, what can we obtain the classical equations, classical wave equations. And for that, we need a few assumptions. First, let's say that the space-time is just an R4 and it's a Minkowski space-time. And for the body manifold, we have a trivial unity metric. So we wanted that our reference in Minkowski space-time is, in absence of any deformation, the same, just that it moves along the four velocity. But what we are interested in are the elastic parts of the material. So we look at small deformations where it differs, and then figure out what we can extract on information there. Further, we split the energy density into a particle number and some stored energy function that consists of a rest mass and an elastic energy in higher orders of epsilon. Lastly, there's a stress-strain relation for homogeneous and isotropic materials that I will use, where the strain is where the stress is related to the strain and these two Lamy parameters. You see here the green strain tensor I was showing before. Okay, let's compute the divergence of the stress energy momentum tensor. We already see here in the first part that we have a particle number conservation of metaflow. So this part gives us zero. And then we have our fall velocity, which obtains an additional term, partial time derivative of the displacement in the spatial components. And we look at small stresses. Neglecting all higher order terms, for the spatial part of the divergence of the stress energy momentum tensor, we obtain a wave equation in terms of the displacement here. Okay, let's try the same thing, but let's look at weak field TT coordinates, so small perturbations of the Minkowski metric, and compute the same divergence again, and then see what impact it has. I can show you later closer how I derived them, but for now, I tell you that they are of high order and we neglect high order terms, so we're only looking at the linear case, and for that, we find a wave equation that's very similar. Except of this last term here on the right-hand side, where we see that we also have a divergence of the gravitational wave, but since we chose TT coordinates using the transversality condition, this vanishes. So we have no gravitational wave contribution here at this part, at this point. And we can now ask if the gravitational wave has no influence at all, which we have to answer with no, because boundary conditions differ from from flat space. And that's imposed boundary conditions. Okay, let's say there are no normal forces on the boundary indicated by this four vector n. From this, we can already just look at the spatial part because we say that the normal forces are orthogonal to the four velocity. So we only have the spatial part of the Cauchy stress. And by imposing that, we only look at a one-dimensional example here. For simplicity, a rod with length L in the x-axis going through the origin, we have certain rod boundary conditions. Computing the stress in this one dimension, we find this relation here for the displacement and the gravitational wave. And we can now use an ansatz for the displacement in terms of a time-dependent parameter beta and some correction for the displacement. On the right-hand side, we have the gravitational wave incidence, and we assume it to be of normal incidence. So we find an exact solution here for the gravitational wave, and we assume it to be cos omega t. Okay, from there, let's continue by plugging in the ansatz. Then we obtain this here, where we can see that on the correction term, we have Neumann boundary conditions, which would be the same as we expected from flat space. And then we have a restriction on beta, which takes this form. So if we now compute the divergence again of the stress energy momentum tensor, we find this inhomogeneous wave equation for the displacement, where we can see that the gravitational wave turns out to be the result of an internal force here on the right-hand side. From this, a full solution of the displacement is given by this displacement function here in terms of wave speeds, C1 and C2. And I want to show you now how this looks if we plot it. Give me a second. Can you see my screen?
Yes, we can see it.
Okay, perfect. So if we plot the solution for this one-dimensional rod, it looks like this. Lastly, I want to point out that in other works, in other literature, it has already been such an inhomogeneous wave equation has already been derived, but as far as I found, I've never seen it being derived straight from the divergence of this energy momentum tensor. Plus, here we also have the material constants, the Lamy parameters, which might be a more precise description because we have obtained from them the wave speeds if necessary. With that, I want to finish my talk, and if there are any questions, feel free to ask.
All right, thank you for your talk. So that was well within time, so we have time for a few questions. Let's start here.
Hello, my question is, what is the direction of the gravitational wave you impose? Because when you have one-dimensional rod and the displacement is along the rod, the gravitational wave cannot be along the axis or along the rod. It should be...
It's supposed to be normal on the stick.
Ah, okay. Thank
you. So I assumed normal incidence.
And how does it follows from your equations? I somehow missed this point. I mean, the point where you restricted your attention to the rod and you suppose mm-hmm. that you have gravitational wave.
Give me a second. You mean at this point here?
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry, can you repeat your question?
I'm specifically interested in the assumption of the gravitational wave you have. Somehow I cannot read it from your equations here. The H, for example.
Sorry, may I add something in here?
The amplitude of the gravitational wave.
You mean the general assumptions on the gravitational wave?
Sorry, may I add something in here?
I see.
So the point is that the assumption of normal incidence basically means that the gravitational wave strain is just the same on both ends of the rod, for example. So if you had an angle for an incidence at an angle, then there would be a phase shift between the strains coming from the right and the left end of the rod. And the assumption here is that these are the same. And independent of the precise length of the rod, for example.
Okay, I see. Thank you.
All right. Then we have one more question back there.
Yeah, thank you for the talk. So what is the relation between the amplitude of the gravitational wave and then the amplitude of the displacement that you obtain?
I'm not sure if I can tell you that.
Here so what I see is that you're assuming the amplitude of the gravitational wave is one, so it should just be proportional to that. But then what is the amplitude of the displacement?
I have to say that I haven't looked into that.
You should just look at the last slide where you have the explicit formula. We can read from that, I guess. So that depends then on the material parameters. So that would be rescaled. The gravitational wave amplitude is normalized to one, and the displacement is then dependent on the frequency omega of the gravitational wave and this material parameters C1, C2, which are the speeds of sound, first and second sound in that material. So it depends on the length also of the rod, for example.
But besides this, the result is just linear in the gravitational wave. So if we had added gravitational wave strength amplitude different from one, then this should be show up linear in the result.
Yeah, so I guess that was basically answers the question that the relation is linear.
Yeah, no, I understand that, and then you just get the amplitude there. But I was wondering what is some value of this coefficient, which it depends on the Lamé parameters of the material, right? Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I don't have a precise value for you.
Yeah. Are there further questions, Piotr?
Yes. So just a few comments. So of course, compared to other equations, I think Mario already said this, right? That he has an explicit formula in terms of the elastic parameters, rather than some abstract numbers, which you can find in a lot of papers. But I think it's striking that when you go to TT gauge, the equations are exactly the same as in flat space time. Everything happens in the boundary conditions. Yeah. But this raises the question: we think that this effect should be coordinate independent, as everything is in GR. But just the proper understanding of this is probably still missing. Do you have any thought of that, Mario or Thomas or Stefan? I've heard all three of you out there.
I would maybe put it like this. So there are two. We have two equations governing the motion, which are the bulk equations, these differential equations, and the boundary conditions. And there are two special coordinate systems. One of them happens to be TT gauge, where we see that the bulk equation, the differential equation, is identical to the case of no gravitational wave at all. So the gravitational wave only enters the boundary conditions in TT gauge. And on the other hand, there was this delta u coordinate, go a bit on a later slide. The problem was transformed to this delta u coordinate. Exactly, yeah. And in this delta u coordinates, the gravitational wave only enters the bulk equation, which is shown here, the lower equation, and doesn't enter the boundary conditions. So the boundary conditions turn out to be just not Neumann conditions for this delta u coordinate. So these are the two special coordinates, the u and the delta u, if you want. And of course, you can do some stupid transformation in between where you happen to have gravitational wave both in the differential equation and in the boundary conditions. But this, of course, will not be of any help.
Okay, I think we cut it at that. So let's thank the speaker again.
Thanks.